Hello and welcome to volume 145 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss funds that are available to forest owners due to losses from hurricanes and tornadoes, how to identify minerals that might be on your property, what to think about when you make a gift, and we'll discuss the timber markets. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Many forest owners will at one time consider gifting land or other assets to members of their family or to charity. Giving something away should be an enjoyable or at least not a painful thing, but there are some things that need to be kept in mind. As our first guest will explain, Robert Tufts is an attorney and professor emeritus at Auburn University. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you, Hayes.
First, let's start with the definition of a gift.
So a gift is a transfer during life of real or personal property for less than full and adequate consideration. So if you give your child a car for graduation, you've actually made a taxable transfer. If you sell something for less than its worth, you've made a part gift, part sale. For example, if you sell your $150,000 house to your son for $50,000, you've made a taxable gift of $100,000, and you must report that gift to the IRS on Form 709.
Okay, you said report it, but does that also mean you pay the tax on the transfer?
So the rate for transfers during life or at death is 40%, but there's an applicable exclusion amount, which is the amount you can transfer before you start paying tax. It's currently $11.7 million, but it changes every year based on inflation or Congress or the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act sunsetting at the end of 2025. We don't have time to address the changes in this talk, but you're required to report the amount of each transfer so the IRS will know when you've exceeded the applicable exclusion amount and have to pay the gift tax.
Are there any transfers that are exempt from gift tax?
Yes, there's an unlimited marital or charitable deduction. So anything you give your spouse or church is not counted. There's also an unlimited deduction for amounts paid on behalf of a donee directly to an educational institution for tuition, but not for books, dormitory fees, or board. There's also an unlimited deduction for medical expenses. Again, you have to pay them directly to the provider, and it has to be for the benefit of the donee. You cannot give the money to the donee for them to pay. You have to pay directly to the provider, both on the education and the medical.
Okay, so exemptions are marital, charitable, educational, and medical. It's like, now, what about giving an amount annually that is not counted?
So, yes, there's an annual exclusion amount. It's currently $15,000, but indexed for inflation. So the $15,000 is per donee per year. One thing you have to be careful of is the gift must constitute a present interest, meaning the donee has access to the gift. So gifts and trusts for business entities may not qualify. Again, don't have time to get into that. This may not sound like much, but when you consider that an individual could gift to his three children and their spouses and maybe six grandchildren, that adds up to $180,000, and your spouse also has that exclusion amount, so you can double that to $360,000 in 1 year before you've even used any of your applicable exclusion amount.
How does something like this apply to forest landowners who may wish to gift something like land that could be of a larger amount than, say, $15,000 per year?
So I would suggest that the landowner create a business entity, several other reasons besides this, but probably a limited liability company or a limited liability limited partnership, transfer the property to the business. Then the owner can simply transfer a percentage interest each year to a child with a simple assignment of interest instead of having to record a deed if you didn't use the business entity. One advantage of the business entity is there may be discounts available for lack of marketability and lack of control. In other words, I wouldn't pay you $15,000 for 15% of a $100,000 family business because the minority interest has no control and there's not much of a market for a family business interest. The discount usually depends on the assets held by the business, but 35% is fairly typical. That means instead of gifting $15,000 worth of the business, the owner may be able to gift $23,077 per donee per year.
Okay. All right. Well, appreciate this introduction to gift taxing. There's a lot more to the topic, but it's done a good job to help us understand a little bit about it. Well, thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you, Hayes.
Tornadoes and hurricanes are a frequent occurrence in Alabama, and two such events recently were Hurricane Michael in 2018 and the tornadoes that affected Lee County in 2019. A grant that is administered by the Alabama Forestry Commission can offer direct cash payments for timber lost because of the storms. Hunter Moncrief with the AFC is with us. Hello, Hunter.
Hey, how are you?
Who is eligible to apply for these funds as a result of these natural disasters?
Okay, so eligibility comes down to the primary and secretarially declared counties from these storms. So a potential applicant must be located in Henry, Houston, Lee, Barber, Pike, Dale, Geneva, Bullitt, Russell, Montgomery, Crenshaw, Coffee, Covington, or Escambia County, and they must own at least 10 acres of forest land.
Okay, so that's the 10 acres, and in those counties, that's the starting point. Is there an application or a form that you need to fill out in order to start the process?
Yes, so there's an online application that can be found directly on the Alabama Forestry Commission's website, and that will take you directly to where you need to apply, and it's a simple process. And once it's turned in, we will process the application and then proceed with site visits and completing the application.
Okay. What if you've already done work on the site, you've done some salvage operation or even clear cut and remove, there's nothing left to see. Is it something you can still apply for at that point?
Yes. So everybody still has an opportunity to apply as long as they meet the eligibility criteria. But with people who perform salvage operations or clear cut and potentially have already replanted, the AFC will be using aerial imagery as well as past damage assessments or previous notes from site visits conducted after the storms. So any information applicants can provide like that will actually help us, and it allows us to better assist them in the process.
Did I say it right? This is a direct cash payment for a volume of timber lost rather than a cost share for replanting or something like that?
Yes. So it won't be directly on a volume like a per ton basis. This is just a loss of timber, and we've come up with some tables that are on our website that have dollar values associated with estimated numbers that we were able to come up with. And it is a direct cash payment that the Forestry Commission will and the state will provide to the landowner. And it's not a cost share program where this money has to be used for replanting. This goes directly into the pocket of the forest landowners of the state of Alabama.
Okay. Well, thank you, Hunter. We appreciate that very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Dane Vandervoot is a geologist, and now what you may have is some idea of what a mineral is, but minerals are classified into different categories, such as critical minerals, of which there's 35, and Dane can help us see why these distinctions are important. Hello, Dane.
Hello, Hayes. How are you doing?
What is a critical mineral and why are they critical?
So critical mineral, so just to provide a little background information on this, and this is, I'm going to talk specifically about critical minerals, but this is really applicable to all really non-fuel mineral resources here. So the United States is currently heavily reliant on imports of certain commodities, and these commodities are essential to ensuring the continued security and economic prosperity of the nation. Right? So in 2018, the U.S. Geological Survey published an updated list identifying 35 commodities that were deemed as being critical. So with this in mind, the USGS and the Geological Survey of Alabama have developed a series of new initiatives to begin locating areas of the state that have a high potential for hosting these critical mineral resources. So as I'm sure your listeners are well aware, Alabama has a long and storied mining history. And as such, the current push from the federal government to begin identifying and producing these resources has the potential to bring a lot of financial and societal investments into many parts of the state that are currently struggling economically due to the collapse of our domestic manufacturing and textile industries. And so, for example, I'm sure many of your listeners have seen the recently announced graphite processing plant that's going to open up in Alexander City here in 2022, but it's projected to inject nearly $125 million into the local economy through capital investments, job opportunities, and infrastructure upgrades. And so if your listeners would like to know more information about the agency's critical mineral programs, I would encourage them to visit the applicable links provided on your show's webpage.
Okay, you mentioned critical minerals as being essential to security and economic prosperity. Which one of these minerals does Alabama have?
So Alabama's actually got several of these minerals. I know the big talk right now is or the big emphasis is on graphite, and that has a lot to do with battery technology. But there are a multitude of these minerals, and these are minerals that are used in telecommunications and defense industry and solar or renewable energy generation and such. So Alabama has known deposits, prospects, and occurrences of at least 19 of the 35 critical minerals identified by the USGS, and we may have as many as 26, and this includes aluminum, arsenic, barite, beryllium, chromium, cobalt, fluorite, graphite, lithium, magnesium, manganese, platinum group metals, rare earth elements, tantalum, tin, titanium, uranium, vanadium, and zirconium, as well as potential occurrences of gallium, germanium, hafnium, indium, niobium, rhenium, and selenium. And so at one point, many of these commodities were considered worthless. However, changing technologies have created a demand for these commodities and has made exploration significantly cheaper than it was in the past. And so, and moreover, many of these resources are often found in conjunction with each other or with other base and precious metals, which means that many historic deposits that were once considered sub-economic are now becoming profitable to exploit. And so, again, see a map showing the locations of our currently known critical mineral resources. I encourage your listeners to, again, visit the Geological Survey of Alabama's critical mineral, non-fuel critical minerals resources webpage.
Let's talk about that. If you are curious about what minerals might be on your property, where would you go to find information?
So on our on the Geological Survey of Alabama's non-fuel critical minerals webpage, we've got an interactive map that you can, that your listeners can kind of search around and see what resources are known around their kind of, in the general area around their property. And if they'd like, some more specific information about what is potentially on their property, they're going to have to conduct resource investigations, to see exactly what they may or may not have.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Dane, thank you very much. We appreciate that very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
In our markets chair is Larry Sullivan with Forest to Markets. Hello, Larry.
Hello there, Hayes. How are you today?
Very, very good. I wanted to talk to you about lumber prices at the retail level and its correlation, if there is one, on stumpage prices. What do you have to offer about that?
Well, generally, there's a very weak correlation. As you know, the stumpage prices, given the vast planting really over the last 30 to 40 years, have yielded a tremendous resource base and the tremendous level of landowner participation from Virginia to East Texas allows that to be a very stable. Insurance companies, as you know, will invest in that type of stability as a hedge against other factors. Now, timber prices, of course, you have the soft timber agreements that have historically put tariffs for low-cost Canadian materials coming in, which always underpinned, a little bit higher price in the U.S., both in the Northwest, Midwest, and then down here in the Southeast. And then you had this situation, as some economists call it a black swan, but it is a situation where the COVID meant people were at home, and so they started driving to the local big box and grabbing all the lumber to fix up the home on top of a very tight market, really, to begin with, because there had not been building out of timber mills to the degree that we see more recently in the last couple of years. So you could say there is a correlation, but it's a very, very weak one. Stuff has remained very stable, where timber is traded on the exchange, and so that's where you see the volatility.
All right. You mentioned some of these, but what are the drivers for wood prices in the Southeast?
Well, wood prices in the stumpage, in other words, at the level of the forestry asset, would be pulp mills, timber mills, of course, pellet mills, and we do heat maps, for example, that would show where you have all these types of timber mills, pulp mills, pellet mills, and even some limited amount of biofuels. And, of course, you have electricity. In other words, there's a number of power plants that use wood assets in there from the Virginia to East Texas. So the driver would be how much competition there is in a basin, or what they say a wood basket, on the fiber. Competition would drive it more. And then you get a situation where there might not be very much competition at all, and there would be very low prices. And so you can look at this through a number of different both state and federal type of programs through the Forest Service and others. And, of course, what our business is to identify those basins, do studies on them, and then present reports to the market.
That sounds like much of the demand side. What about the supply side? Is the oversupply of timber also a driver in prices?
Yeah, you could say that there have been, through the 1980s, of course, you're seeing with the tax changes in the 1980s Tax Act, the Reagan administration, and then some conservation reserve programs in the 90s. Both of those led to, in some ways, conversion of lands into forestry. So those 30-year assets are beginning to present themselves. You won't necessarily use the word oversupply, but it's a basin-by-basin or region-by-region examination. Historically, the South has moved from agriculture. Agriculture went to the Midwest more, and then the South was left with, in a sense, more and more forestry land, which is, the natural environment prior to agriculture and settlement was forestry. So you can see in some ways it's a return to the future, back to the future, as they say.
Mm-hmm. What, can you say a bit about the new technologies like wood pellets and biofuels? How do they fit in the traditional markets that we're accustomed to, like lumber and pulpwood?
Yeah, they fit quite nicely because in many ways timber mills produce, a certain percentage. Hog fuel, of course, they might consume themselves, but there's about 10-20% of a timber mill that would be pellet material. In other words, there's a symbiosis or a situation where they live in close proximity. Ideally, a pellet mill would be using that waste. And, of course, pellet mills might have to acquire some of their own resource. Pulp mills have used the pellet mill model also, meaning there's some proximity between those two related to pulpwood, or the supply of pulpwood in a basin. So these new technologies actually enhance the landowner's position because in some cases, if there's three or four bidders for materials, then that benefits the landowner.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Larry. We appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Robert Tuss, Hunter Moncrief, Dane Vandervoort, and Larry Sullivan. All of these guests have helped us see that managing timberland is not as simple as it sounds, from reacting to weather events on the surface of the earth, to understanding minerals beneath the surface, to being familiar with economics and tax policy. Forest owners need to multitask to keep up, and that's why programs like this can be a vital part of being a successful timberland owner. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.